Good evening and welcome behind the news for May 31st, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics. And two segments up tonight. First, we'll be talking about restaurants, specifically work in restaurants. No gastro porn, just working conditions. We'll be hearing from Raj Nayak of the Brennan Center and Rajani Adnakari of the Restaurant Opportunities Center. We'll be hearing about a proposed bill in the city council called the Responsible Restaurant Act, but also working conditions in that industry, which sometimes comes with high prices, but the high prices don't necessarily correlate with high wages for the people behind the kitchen door. And then at the bottom of the hour, it's a little bit unusual for this program, but why not? We'll be hearing from Sadia Tour, who is teaches at the College of Staten Island and is involved with the CLAGS, the Center on Lesbian and Gay Studies at the CUNY Grad Center, and Kourash Shemirani, who is that's a pseudonym for a writer and Iranian-American activist. And we'll be hearing we'll be talking about how we should think about the horrors perpetrated on sexual minorities and women in Iran and many other predominantly Muslim countries. What can Westerners do, if anything? What should Westerners think about this? And does outrage feed into the imperial designs of the Bush administration? What is to be done, to coin a phrase? That will be at the bottom of the hour. And I wanted to, before we get going with the interviews, a few words of introduction. Thanks to all of you who pledged during our recent fundraiser, and special thanks to those of you who pledged during this time slot. If you asked us to bill you, please don't forget to send your check. But what is it about these fundraisers that doesn't always bring out the best in us? In the few before this last one, there were the 9/11 conspiracy videos, paranoid nonsense that nonetheless made the phones ring. I've complained about these before, so I won't bore you with another rant again. Let me just say that the kind of paranoid conspiratorial thinking embodied in those video products used to be associated mainly with the far right. That's where it belongs, with people who are chronically suspicious of outsiders and look for grossly oversimplified explanations of how the world works. It's sad to see Peace and Justice Radio embracing a view of the world that was once mainly the province of the John Birch Society. In the most recent fundraiser, the import from the paranoid right was the Money Masters, how international bankers gained control of America. Now, I do have a problem with offering premiums at high prices that can be gotten free on the web. This one is on Google Video. It's sad that we have to raise money on supposedly hot commodities rather than relying on the excellence of our programming. WFMU raises money on bumper stickers, CD compilations, and T-shirts, not sensationalized videos that purport to unmask the truth and actually confuse it. But leave that aside for now. What about the content of the thing? The Money Masters is a classic piece of right-wing monetary theory. It was amazing here to hear the reverence for our founding fathers, a bunch of aspiring capitalists and slave-owning aristocrats, on these airwaves. I was stunned to hear Andrew Jackson treated as a hero. Jackson was a racist and a murderer of Indians, and one who lived in a bigger house, I might add, than his arch-rival Nicholas Biddle, the president of the Bank of the United States. Jackson was a model for today's right-wing populist, uncultured, barely literate, but with aristocratic pretensions, a land speculator from the sticks who affected contempt for the more cultured speculators of the cities, a man who favored action, often violent action, over thought and reflection, and one who had no particular problem with hierarchies of rich and poor themselves, just ones involving particular personnel. Jacksonian democracy, like right-wing populism, is not a political philosophy meant to give power to the working class. It's the philosophy of an entrepreneur who feels excluded by his richer brethren. The economic theory behind these sorts of screeds is classic monetary crankery. By monetary crankery, I mean that it locates all our economic problems in the monetary and financial spheres, and if we fix those, everything else will fall into place. It somehow separates money from the rest of the capitalist racket, which is strange since the whole capitalist racket is about the accumulation of money and the use of that money to make more money and using that more money to make even more money and so on. This particular specimen of monetary crankery proposes the replacement of fractional reserve banking, a system that allows banks to lend out far more than they hold in reserves, with a 100% reserve system. Technicalities aside, the effect of that would be to restrict the availability of credit, which is odd since most monetary cranks usually criticize the system for not providing enough credit. Restricting credit, though, would mean slower growth and higher unemployment rates. If you look back in the period after Jackson destroyed the Bank of the United States, that moment through the founding of the Federal Reserve in 1913, you see a period of inflation around the time of the Civil War, which made a lot of capitalists rich at the expense of the working class, followed by a major bust in the early 1870s and decades of deflation. About half the time during the second half of the 19th century was spent in financial panic and depression. Is this the model we're supposed to recover? Where monetary crankery thrives, anti-Semitism is often not far from the surface. The language of the money masters is full of anti-Semitic innuendo and religious appeals to Jesus driving the money changers out of the temple. But there's actually a good reason for the affiliation of crankery and anti-Semitism. Just as crankery tries to locate all the evils of capitalism, the instability, the lust for accumulation, the tendencies towards polarization of rich and poor, locate all those in the monetary sphere, classical anti-Semitism locates all the evils of capitalism among the Jews. Really, people, can't we do better than this? Monetary economics is complicated. It's a lot easier to think of it as a conspiracy of a small group of people who met secretly one day a century ago to create the Federal Reserve in order to enrich themselves by robbing us. International politics is complicated. It's a lot easier to think of it as a puppet show manipulated by the sinister offstage figure of Dick Cheney. I know that talking about complexity isn't going to make the phones ring the way premiums that promise to reveal the secrets of the world in an hour or so will make them ring. But these things marginalize us and make us stupid, and it might have something to do with a shrinking audience and a fundraiser that falls almost a third short of its target. You'd almost think it was a conspiracy. And let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about restaurants. And that the usual theme of conspiracy theories, a bit from the Mekons' Insignificance. And now we're back then to talk about restaurants. We're joined in the studio by Raj Nayak, who is with the Brennan Center at NYU, a human and worker rights think tank, is it, I guess, within NYU, associated with the NYU Law School.
Exactly.
And Rajani Nakari, who is with the Restaurant Opportunity Center. And we'll be here to talk about restaurants. Let's start by talking about the working conditions in the restaurants of New York City. And we're not talking about Blimpies and McDonald's. We're talking about pretty nice places with high prices, right?
Absolutely.
So, you know, when you pay $20 for a plate full of grilled vegetables.
Right.
What's it like to work behind the door where that stuff is prepared at those high prices?
Absolutely. I mean, what we found is that, unfortunately, the working conditions are really across the board and across the industry. So we found that about 13% of restaurant workers in January 2005 were reporting not even making $5.15 an hour, which was minimum wage at that time. 60% of workers are saying that they're not receiving their rightful overtime pay. And that workers' compensation, oftentimes restaurant owners don't even have workers' compensation insurance. And if they don't, or even if they do, they'll offer money to workers to stay home and not go through the process.
Restaurants are, kitchens are dangerous places. Lots
Absolutely.
Of sharp things and hot things, right?
Absolutely. So. There's a lot of dangerous situations that workers are being put into. And also, they're not being trained properly, unfortunately. So, you know, we're getting hurt at higher numbers. There's a statistic that says that after firefighters and police officers, restaurant workers are the first to be in the emergency rooms in New York City. And that's largely also due to the fact that about 90% of us don't have health insurance from our employers, and 75% don't have any health insurance at all.
Who are us exactly? Who are the? It seems to me, just as a restaurant patron, that the labor market in the restaurant work is very segmented. It's very ethnicized.
Absolutely.
Certain kinds of people fill certain kinds of jobs. Mm-hmm. So my impression is correct. Fill in some of the details
Absolutely.
For us.
Absolutely. There's 165,000 restaurant workers in New York City, and 70% are immigrant or foreign born. What we find is that there are some good jobs. The positions of managers and bartending and even server in many places are, you know, provide really good wages, you know, $80,000 to $100,000 a year in some really fancy restaurants.
Now, the server positions, though, the high-paying ones tend to be very male, don't they?
Male,
is that still the case?
Male and white. You know, this is the population that gets to have those good jobs. And unfortunately, you know, people of color, immigrants, tend to be put in the jobs that are oftentimes most dangerous and oftentimes, you know, lowest paid.
What about behind where you can't see? What goes on behind the kitchen door is, I think, what you titled one of your reports. Yes,
that's right. Yeah, behind the kitchen door. It's very similar. There are workers who work dishwasher to line cook who are in the industry for years and years and, you know, never have the chance to be promoted to not the front of the house, nor do they get to be promoted to actually become sous chef or head chef. So there's a lot of discrimination. There's a lot of health and safety violations and a lot of damage that's done to restaurant workers.
Yeah, I remember I read a comment once by the guy who owns Landmark Restaurant saying, you know, people talk about how cooking is in your blood. Actually, just give me a dozen Mexicans and I can train them to cook. So that is what's going on in
there's some
high-end restaurants
there's
in
there? There's some really blatant discrimination and racism that exists in high-end restaurants and, you know, across the board. And we find that, you know, there's a lot of discrimination against undocumented workers. Obviously, there's a lot of threats that are made. 40% of the industry is undocumented. We don't have any real solid numbers, but that's what we estimate. That's being used all the time to kind of create fear so that workers don't stand up for their rights or at least, you know, they try to use that to let workers not stand up for their rights.
What's the compensation mechanism? How do people get paid less than the minimum wage?
Oftentimes workers are paid for the week, so they'll get like $300 for the week. And yet when you calculate actually how many hours people are working, sometimes they're working 10, 11, 12 hours a day for 6 days a week. We had a case of that happening in a diner in New York City, pretty famous diner.
And do people put up with those kinds of hours in the hope and the kind of pay in the hope of rising in the ranks, or is it just they're going to stay there forever?
You know, that's a really difficult question. I don't know why people stay. I mean, we at Rock New York, we have a membership of about 1,800 restaurant workers, and what we try to do is spread the word that even if you're undocumented, even if you don't have legal working papers, you know, in the United States, you do have the right to make minimum wage and you do have the right to make overtime. And oftentimes that comes as a bit of a shock to a lot of workers.
But then once they find that out, what can they do about it?
Well, we encourage them to organize. You know, we have had six campaigns, victorious campaigns, and our last victory was 23 workers from the Smith & Wolensky company. They own Park Avenue Cafe and Cité. 23 workers, largely undocumented, came forward and said that they weren't being paid overtime, that there was a lot of discrimination. The chef was very verbally abusive and racist and calling them all kinds of awful things. So with them, we kind of have a two-pronged approach. We litigate, we sue, but we also really put the pressure on with a grassroots kind of action, meaning media campaigning and, you know, standing outside of the restaurant with protests and flyering. Right now we have a really major campaign at the Shelley Fireman Hospitality Group with six different restaurants, 250 workers coming forward from both the front and the back of the house. You know, and they have issues of non-payment of minimum wage, overtime, they have sexual harassment, they have racial discrimination, they have everything that you can possibly imagine going on. And those are midtown, very fancy, fine dining restaurants.
Well, up in my neighborhood, there's a protest, organized protest against Saigon Grill, mm-hmm. which has been doing, mm-hmm. I guess, just pretty much what you describe. But if it's so ubiquitous, how do you choose what targets to go after?
Workers come to us with their issues. And so, you know, we obviously kind of research their claims and make sure that they're valid. But we also encourage workers to bring their coworkers. Our campaign at the Fireman Hospitality Group started with two young white waiters who came and said, we just found out that, you know, tipping out our managers is illegal. And, you know, we said, well, if that's happening to you, think about what's happening to the rest of the restaurant, or we call it the house.
Tipping out, that means giving the manager pockets the tips.
A portion, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the workers came back with 60, you know, and that's how we encourage organizing. We say it's not just about an individual case, but it's really about, you know, making sure that there are improvements to the workplace across the board.
And so it's also a very volatile business. Restaurants come and go with stunning speed. How does that affect the workers?
Absolutely. Well, what we find is that oftentimes you think of the restaurant industry as very transient, that people are kind of in and out. But in fact, workers really are in the industry for years and years and years. I mean, we have workers who've worked in the industry for 30 years and more. So, you know, even if a restaurant might close, you know, you'll find another restaurant job down the street.
And that is the voice of Rajani Adnakari, who is with the Restaurant Opportunity Center. And by the way, what is the Restaurant Opportunity Center?
We are a membership-based organization of restaurant workers from across New York City, fighting for the rights of restaurant workers.
And I think it's not unlikely that maybe some restaurant workers will be listening. So if they've got a complaint or an inquiry, who do they contact?
Well, our office is at 275 7th Avenue on the 17th floor, and they're always willing. We're always open for them. And our phone number is 212-343-1771.
Okay. And Raj Nayak from the Brennan Center. What, you have anything you want to add to that before I ask you some questions?
Well, what I was going to say is what's so great about Rock New York is a lot of these campaigns are really high-profile campaigns. They're doing a great job of getting the word out about the employment law violations here. Unfortunately, that's only one piece of what we need to do more broadly to target all the restaurant workers and to make sure that they know their rights and that they have a recourse. And so one of the things we've been working on with Rock New York is trying to figure out a way for the city of New York to send a signal to employers that that it's really not optional to comply with these important workplace laws, to try to get at the violations that are so ubiquitous in the city that are becoming really business practice across the restaurant industry here.
Yeah, well, as I was saying earlier, that some of these restaurants, the prices are stunningly high. Is it that the cost of doing business is so high, or they're earning enormous profits? Where does all that money go?
That's a good question. We're a part of our work is also partnering with good employers who are really taking the high road and who make decisions based on treating their workers with respect and dignity. And we were at a meeting recently with them, and one of them said, it's a decision of priorities. And these folks who really decide to take the high road by offering paid sick days, by complying with basic laws and then going above and beyond, their profit margins are less. They know that they're not going to make as much money as, the guys who are taking advantage of their workers.
So it really couldn't be a win-win situation. They'll actually have to give up something by treating the workers well. Much of what I know about conditions in the restaurant business is from reading Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential. But he describes what often sounds like a pretty hellish environment, very, very sexist, very racist, lots of injuries, but also a lot of mean people, a lot of strange and mean people. He says, I can't say this word because it's on the list of seven words, but I'm an a-hole and you should be too if you want to get into this business.
Right.
Is there anything to that?
There's a certain it kind of feeds itself. A lot of us who've been in the industry for a long time, we started as bussers and, runners, and we move up in the industry or, we've been in the kitchen for years and years.
What do you do?
I'm a waitress and a bartender. But it becomes a community, and unfortunately, there are some really bad ground rules in our community, and we shouldn't put up for it. And at restaurants that I've worked at, I've had both the good and the bad. I've had really great management, really great chefs who respect us and treat us with dignity, and then I've had the flip side of that. And unfortunately, it's groundbreaking to think of being nice to, your employer, your employees in this industry. We're at a really bad place right now.
And what's so disturbing is when Rajani says being nice, it's just, what we're looking for is certainly employers who go above and beyond, but even just employers who comply with the basic laws that are on the books, paying the minimum wage, paying overtime, and you know, make, and not discriminating in hiring promotions. These aren't, you know, these aren't huge things to ask.
How important is the immigration status of a lot of workers? Do employers take advantage of the fact that people are here not under the blessing of the United States government?
Yeah, I think that unfortunately a lot of employers will use that. But you know, one thing we tell our workers is that, you know, the employers are at as much fault for hiring you.
And to be clear, it's not a defense to, you know, to these kinds of violations. Mm-hmm. Just because, regardless of someone's documentation status, they're still owed the minimum wage, they're still owed overtime, and that's not something that that should keep them from, you know, from asserting their rights. Mm-hmm. It is something, though, that, you know, employers can use to discourage people. You know, the fear of retaliation does discourage people from asserting their rights, and so that's why it's important to support policies and organizing campaigns and other things that can help workers collectively enforce their rights.
And what about unions in this business? Mm-hmm. There are some unionized restaurants, not very many of them. How active are they, and how do the workers feel? Do they want unions?
About 1% of the industry is unionized, and
that's in the city,
in New York City, 1%. You know, it's kind of like what Raj is saying. You know, we're talking about basic compliance right now, and you know, while I think unionization is definitely in our vision, I think right now we have a lot of work to do just on the very basics.
Yes, so employers pay the minimum wage, $5.15. You'd think that's not too onerous for a place charging $25 for an entree, but I guess it is. So, what is the Brennan Center doing about this?
So, we've been working with Rock New York to try to figure out: is there a way that the city of New York, as a city, can start to get at these violations? And so, working with Rock and Council members Joya and Mendez, we've designed the Responsible Restaurant Act, which is a way, again, that the city can send the signal that compliance with these laws is really important. The basic idea behind the Responsible Restaurant Act is that the city licenses these restaurants. It decides, you know, who to give a permit, who not to give a permit when they apply, and to say to the health department, you know, when restaurants are coming to you and they're seeking a license, think about their employment law violations. You know, ask them to disclose what employment law violations that they have, and you know, just send the message that the city's watching. It's not asking the health department to take any particular action, but it is telling the restaurants that, hey, if you have a documented history of employment law violations, this could be taken into account as the health department's deciding whether or not to grant your license.
Well, they have health inspectors in there searching for you know, rat hairs and roaches and poorly refrigerated dairy products. Are there no inspections of how the workers are being treated?
No.
Not currently. And we're not even the great thing about this policy that we've come up with is it's not necessarily requiring the health department to go out and do inspections. I mean, I think we'd all for workers' rights issues. Well, a lot of us would love that. You know, would require a lot of administrative resources. All we're asking is that when restaurant owners who are applying for their license send in their applications, that they disclose what violations they have. We're giving the public a chance to you know, to send in written comments to say, you know, here's how we feel about the restaurant's violations. If a restaurant doesn't disclose violations, to send in comments about that. And then asking the health department could decide to, you know, convene a public hearing to gather more information. But we're not asking them to go out and inspect every restaurant for their employment law violations, just to consider the violations.
Why not? I mean, why not go all the way?
We would love that. But, you know, we've been working for the last 3 years with the Restaurant Industry Coalition, council members, and the administration to see, you know, some kind of bill that will send a strong message that will do good for restaurant workers, and a bit of a compromise as well.
And it's a pretty small thing to ask. We think it's pretty basic to say that again, these are violations that are, you know, they've already gone through the courts, just for the city to and we'll give the city that information. Then the city can use it in egregious circumstances. You know, think about taking action against restaurants that are depending on employment law violations as a business practice.
And is there ever any thought of suing employers for, you know, patterns of abuse or systematic violations?
Yeah, that's what our campaigns are about. You know, we sue employers, and then we also do the protests. So right now, you know, the Fireman Hospitality Group has 250 lawsuits against them pending.
250 lawsuits.
Yeah, 250 workers coming forward, you know, fighting for their rights. The one thing also that we have to say is that We fight for back wages and things that they were owed, but we also fight for improvements to their workplace. For example, in the Smith and Walensky campaign, the workers did get about $164,000 that they were owed. Actually, they were owed much more, but that was the agreement. But what was also given to them were things like paid sick days, vacation time. They got an employee manual. They got lunch breaks, things that are, you know, improvements to their workplace.
And you have a report on the Restaurant Opportunity Center website, Dining Out, Dining Healthy, a link between public health and working conditions. What's that about?
That's right. Well, unfortunately, what we found is that restaurant owners who tend to violate labor laws are also putting the public health at risk because they tend to cut corners on things like training their workers properly on machinery. They tend to put less resources behind making sure that food is not spoiled or expired when they serve it. And so what we found is that this issue is about us as workers, 165,000, you know, workers in New York City. But it is also about the dining community, and everyone in New York City is a diner. So it really affects us all.
Yeah, that's pretty restaurants are a major activity in the city.
Yeah.
And it's funny how, you know, restaurants have now become like just gastro porn and celebrity chefs and everything.
Yeah,
it's, it's such a prominent and high-end business, but people don't think about what's going on behind the scenes.
Right.
What can just ordinary diners do? Is there anything that they can do to help the workers out?
Well, in this case, definitely they can contact their council members and ask them to support the Responsible Restaurant Act with us to try to get this legislation passed.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly,
We're working with this group of good employers that we're trying to promote. And actually in July in Restaurant Week, we plan on going public with who they are. And so what we want to prove to New York City and to, you know, diners everywhere is that if you treat your workers well, there's a benefit to that. And so we're going to be coming out with this list of restaurants, and hopefully, you know, diners will be looking out for them. It's called the Roundtable Code of Conduct, and we're going to be having a little insignia, and they can, you know, make sure that their restaurant is signed on.
When is this being released?
In July.
And are you publishing thinking of publishing a list of evildoers as well?
Unfortunately, we're at this stage where you can assume that most are not doing this.
Okay, so if they're not on the good guys list, they're bad guys, basically. Is that the way it works?
Well, we're trying to get to every single restaurant to give them a fair chance to sign on, so we'll see what happens.
And how are you going to announce and publicize this?
We're going to be having a press conference in during Restaurant Week, so we're trying to work with NYC and Co. to see if we can do something in collaboration. But, you know, we're working with a lot of different city agencies who really like this idea, who believe that, you know, go after the good guys, sure, but also really promote the – I'm sorry, go after the bad guys, sure, but also really promote the good guys. And there are you know, right now we at least have a handful of them, and they're doing good things. And so we want to make sure we reward them.
And what kind of reception are you getting at the city council?
I think city council members are excited because I think that, you know, a lot of their constituents, this is one of the largest low-wage industries in the city. 165,000 workers is a considerable number. And I think they see a lot of their constituents who are struggling to get by, who could be, if they were earning, you know, just the minimum wage and the overtime that they're owed, actually have a fighting chance to get out of poverty.
And since the mayor, the richest man in town, professes to be interested in getting people out of poverty, I hope he's listening. And again, the contact info for the Restaurant Opportunity Center?
Our phone number is 212-343-1771, and we're on 7th Avenue between 25th and 26th.
And that is 275
7th?
Okay, well, thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Raj Nayak from the Brennan Center, and the last voice you heard, Rajani Adnakari from the Restaurant Opportunity Center. And let's take a little break for station ID, and we'll be back to talk about Iran and such.
Hi, this is Taj Mahal, and this is WBAI, listener-supported radio in New York City. Music that's melting in your mind.
And this is WBAI, 99.5 on your FM dial and also on the web at WBAI.org. And again, if you pledged during the recent fundraiser, don't forget to send in your check. And if you forgot to, well, you can go to the website, WBAI.org, and make your pledge. And let's take a musical break, and we will be back to speak with Sadia Tour and Kuresh Shemirani.
Say you don't know what love means.
And we're back. That a bit from Electrolane's latest album. Let me see if I can find my cheat sheet here. No, I can't. But it's the first song on the new Electrolane album, which just came out a couple of weeks ago. And, well, let's see. Doug Ireland has a post in his blog. Oh, I should say we're joined in the studio now. I forgot this part. By Sadia Tour, who teaches as a sociologist, who teaches at the College of Staten Island and is also involved with the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies at the CUNY Grad Center, and Kourosh Shemirani, who is a founder of the Queer Iran Alliance and journalist, activist on such issues. And here we see on a recent post on Doug Ireland's blog, Ireland, horrific new photos of Iran's torture of gays plus 87 arrested in a raid on a gay party. The photos show the welts from severe whippings that a couple of men received. And he also reports on what he calls a brutal and violent raid by the Iranian authorities on a birthday party, in which they suspected was a gay party, beating the guests and arresting 87 people, including four women, one of whom had a child with her. Now, someone who is queer-friendly would look at this and say, this is horrific. What do we do about it? So how should someone in the West, sitting here in the relative comfort and a relative freedom of New York City, think about something like this? What do we do?
Should I go first?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that Doug Ireland is choosing this moment in history to talk about these issues the way he is. Whippings is not something new in Iran. He had photographs of the two people who had been whipped on his website. People have been whipped.
Well, a year or so ago he did the hanged.
The hanging, which too. And there was a big question about whether or not, you know, they were hanged because they were gay or not. And recently, the article that you're reading about, he had pictures of people who've been whipped, supposedly for being gay. I'm not sure if that's true or not. It could be true. It's just people are whipped for many different kinds of reasons in Iran, and they have been for the past 25 years since the Islamic Revolution. Sort of whipping has been one of the ways that sort of Islamic law has been implemented in Iran. So this is nothing new in the whippings. Just talking about it in terms of a new wave of anti-gay whippings and stuff is just sort of it's sort of historically inaccurate, basically, because there's nothing new about this. People have been whipped. My father was whipped because he was drinking alcohol. You know what I mean? Whipping is just when I saw this, I'm like, why is this hysteria being created right now? The question really is not whether this happened or not. It happened and it happens, you know, continuously. And I think because of the pressures that the U.S. is placing on Iran, there's been a crackdown on various groups of people, students, workers, women, you know, all kinds of, moral things are being enforced more heavily now. So, I mean, this is all part of a larger sort of problem in Iran. To talk about it in terms of gays being targeted, I think that was actually wrong.
Why is there an intensification? Is it because of the U.S. jacking up the hostility?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a hunt. The Iranian government is claiming that it has found cells of pro-American espionage in Iran. The Iranian government is actively going after people who it sees as being fifth columns. Because Cheney was just there 2 weeks ago off the coast of Iran in a gunboat saying that we will not rule out the use of force with Iran. The U.S. right now has got the largest fleet of warships in the Persian Gulf since 2003. So, I mean, for Iranians, Americans are threatening and getting ready to attack them. So when that happens, of course, they turn inward. You know, same way that Americans turned inward after 2001, September 11th, and all kinds of violence came out of that as a reaction to it, Iranians are doing the same thing. So what's going on in Iran is intensification of paranoia, basically, because America, you know, continuously is ratcheting up its threats. And you don't really get a sense of this through the American media, of course, but if you read the Iranian press, it's becoming a shrill kind of a moment in Iran. And they're turning inwards and they're targeting all sorts of people. You know, so talking about it in terms of gays in so many ways actually it's sort of a very wrong way of talking about it. It's actually sort of creating targets out of gays when the Iranian government is actually not targeting gays at this point.
Well, but you wouldn't deny that the regime is an oppressive one.
No, I'm just saying. Just got finished saying that they've been oppressing all kinds of people.
I
really want to know what is the point of putting this moment in the context of attacks on gays? What does that do?
Well, but, okay, so people, there was also a feminist demonstration a couple of months ago, which was reportedly broken up and women thrown in jail for merely demonstrating in favor of women's rights.
And students have been banned from university. The security forces have gone on university campuses, dragging people off campuses. Labor leaders are in jail now, have been getting some very harsh sentences. I'm not denying any of this.
Yes.
What I'm questioning is, what is the point of picking one group out of many groups that are being targeted, you know, and making that the sort of the face of the Islamic Republic, the face of the repression of the Islamic Republic? Well, I'm not sure what good that does.
Do you have any sense of why you think it might be?
I think someone should ask Doug Ireland that, why he's doing that. I mean, no one's really, I'm really sorry to say, a lot of people talk to him, but no one asks him the question, why are you doing this?
But I think that's part of the larger question that, you know, Kurosh and I have tried to deal with in many separate fora and together as well, in particular in the CLAGS panel that we did together. This issue of, you know, quite aside from the fact that I don't think any progressive would dispute that these violations of human rights exist in the quote-unquote Muslim world as they do elsewhere in the world, right? So not to fall into any kind of apologetics for that, but to ask really the question and ask American progressives the question or progressives in the North, the global North, the question, why this sudden, you know, focus on violations of women's rights and gay rights in the quote-unquote Muslim world, right? And I think that you cannot really understand or unpack the issues at stake unless you answer that question and understand how and why at precise. I mean, I think the Iran example is really quite stunning because the, you know, Doug Ireland sort of picking up that issue of the execution of the two gay teenagers came at exactly the time when the American interests in attacking Iran were being exposed, right? So there you have actually a very, you know, like as I said, just a stunning sort of connection between American imperialism and imperialist designs and someone who is not obviously directly connected with that project, but and yet through certain kinds of progressive politics feeds the kind of Islamophobia and anti-Iran sentiment that is needed by the American state at a very strategic point in time. And so I think even, you know, to understand the complexities of this issue post the war on terror, I mean, the war on terror has created an environment in which Islamophobia is rife. I mean, I was reading a recent survey that says that Islamophobia is at its height today in the U.S., much more so even than in the short period following the attacks in September 11th. It's at an all-time height. So it's impossible really to understand what to do as progressives in that context in the North without understanding, you know, how certain kinds of how these images and these discourses are linked in some way to Islamophobia, right?
Yeah, no, I've known Doug Ireland for quite a long time. I don't know him well, but I've known him for quite a long time. And I really doubt he would be in favor of invading Iran. And I think a lot of other people who take these positions.
Right? I mean, so you don't have to be in favor of invading Iran in order to be a liberal imperialist. You know what I mean?
And that this is true. But
there's a tradition within the Anglo-Saxon world of liberal imperialism. And I think we're getting to a point in America where progressives have to decide whether they think some good can come out of American sort of expeditions across the world, which is, I think, what Doug Ireland is really hoping. You know, to use somehow this American pressure on Iran to make life a little better for gays in Iran. And that's a strategy that I think he's using and I do openly call it a liberal imperialist kind of a project.
The liberal imperialists, though, were very much in favor of bombing Serbia. I don't know that the liberal imperialists are so enthusiastic about bombing Iran.
Well, I think Doug Ireland
is spearheading. The Clinton administration is the agent of this.
I think what's happening is that some people are taking the step of spearheading that ideology being opened up. That maybe Iran is so horrible that, you know, by example, how they're whipping gay people, you know, all these images, maybe it's so bad that some good can come out of our imperialist venture there. And that's something that happens all the time. Like every time there's an American kind of attack on another country, you need liberals to justify it for a large chunk of American people. And I think it's time for progressives in this country to decide, do I really think that American imperialism can do some good, or is American imperialism is ultimately a bad thing that I stand against? You know, and that's the choice that I think Americans are being pushed, I mean, or will have to be pushed to make. And Doug Ireland is clearly spearheading one side of it. That's just, but that's not necessarily, I mean, a progressive agenda. You asked in the beginning, what should progressives in the West do? And I've said this before. When you live in the largest imperialist power in the world, a lot of times you're powerless in helping other people because you're identified with George Bush. You know what I mean? I mean, you identify with the country that's actually using its power for its own interests. So to expect that power to be used for some good, it might not happen. What you have to do is to get rid of George Bush. You know, that's how you can help Iranian gays. And if you forget that, you know what I mean? You might actually help George Bush in his agenda.
I'm afraid, though, if Hillary Clinton were to succeed him, we might not be
exactly,
much better off.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, I think she might actually use Doug Island's line
to justify,
I mean, and that's the scary part of what's happening.
Well, then the Bush administration discovered it's inter-feminist when they were about to bomb Afghanistan.
The Bush regime can't use protecting gays because it'll lose its own base, because it has answers to its own homophobic base.
Yeah, Dick Cheney's daughter, he's not about
right.
to be
right.
moved
you know,
by
but,
this
you know, the contradictions are everywhere. But some a liberal coming in, and that's my sort of biggest fear, a liberal coming in will use this kind of, you know, this kind of liberal criticism of Iran to then justify attacking Iran and furthering the attacks on Iran, you know, with a large number of people who might actually not support it. And that's what Doug Island is doing. He's opening up that space. He's opening up that possibility of a liberal attack on Iran. And that a liberal attack on Iran is no better than a conservative attack on Iran. That's the point.
And I think actually that, you know, people like Doug Island are much more problematic in some ways than people who are straightforwardly neoconservative, right? Because their politics are very open and their agenda is very open, or at least ultimately it is. But the problem with discourses like Doug Island's is that because they are designed to, or they, you know, whether they're designed to or not, they do sort of pull on and come out of American liberalism. The danger is that, I mean, there is a long history, as you know, Kurosh just said, of liberal imperialism coming out of Europe and North America, of the ways in which in which human rights discourses have been used for imperialist ends, and the rest of the world knows this because the rest of the world has been at the receiving end of, you know, those weapons, right? So what happens when American liberals and leftists who are not aware of the history of their own country's implications in neocolonialism and now imperialism jump to the defense of what, you know, well-meaning defense in their view of gays and women and other minorities, what they don't understand is how that actually makes things much more difficult for progressives fighting in those spaces. So again, as Kurosh said, you know, jumping to a gay rights agenda that is explicitly anti-Iranian and is, you know, can be seen to be feeding a very particular, whether indirectly or not, particular American imperialist interest, it makes it incredibly difficult for progressives in Iran to actually, you know, have any leverage, because then they become seen as fifth columnists. They become seen as, you know, it just functions as, you know, kind of proof that their agenda is not an indigenous and legitimate agenda, mm-hmm. that it's an agenda that's being fed by imperial, mm-hmm. you know, American imperialism.
That's the voice of Sadia Tour, who is in here in the studio with Kurosh Shemirani. Well, you know, I've had some very liberal, even pretty far left people sort of like confide, it's a terrible religion, Islam. Now, what is it in the American mind that, or even in the American liberal left mind, that is so prone to find Islam a truly horrible religion? What is the root of Islamophobia?
You tell us. I mean, you've obviously talked to them much more than, you know, I probably have, because they would never admit that to me. Well, I mean, there are arguments and analyses that people have presented over the years for the rise of Islamophobia, and, you know, some of them, Edward Said was one person who made the connection through, you know, his book Orientalism and the arguments in there. And, you know, other people have since followed up on that in terms of how post-Cold War, the American state needed another enemy and also not just needed another enemy, but the only other sort of organized political force that seemed to be opposing American interests abroad seemed to be this radical Islam, right, which was a complete product of the Cold War itself, right?
Yeah, well, that's an important point, and I think could you expand on that? How is this kind of radical Islam a product of the Cold War?
Well, it's a product of the Cold War. There are many different sort of ways to trace the history of that, and one of that is one because a lot of it is a product of modernism and modernization and colonialism, right? And insofar as the Cold War picked up on the colonial project, insofar as it was a neo-colonial project, it kind of, you know, sort of laid the base for it. But the Cold War, I mean, it's been rehearsed so many times. If you think about, if you think specifically about what the U.S. did in Afghanistan in terms of creating the Taliban and in terms of creating a radical Islamic base, that's, I mean, I think one of the clearest kinds of examples of the ways in which the Cold War has fed Islamic radicalism, a particular kind of Islamic radicalism, which they thought they could control, and which they, you know, and they thought they were playing this complex chess game to contain the Soviet Union, but it backfired on them, right? Particularly once the Soviet Union was no longer a force, right? And then it is, you know, a genie that came out of the bottle that you were unable to control, and now, you know, thanks again to U.S. Cold War interests, the rest of the world has to deal with this genie, right? And it has really, really, really changed the face of politics in most of the, you know, the so-called Muslim world, right? In, and it was during the Cold War that leftists, communists, Marxists of all stripes were systematically, you know, eliminated, either actively, you know, literally killed or marginalized. And again, through American support, right, for
And religion was encouraged as an alternative
exactly,
to secular radicalism.
Very
right?
much so.
I mean, as even the Israelis promoted Hamas in the
yes,
early days.
Yes, very much so, because the big you know, bully or the big sort of, you know, monster was the Soviet Union and communism, and the only other, you know, organized political force that seemed to exist was Islam, and so they used it, thinking that, you know, that they would be able to control it. The other aspect of the Cold War that people don't necessarily talk much about when they're tracing the roots of Islamic radicalism or the rise of Islamic radicalism was really the neocolonial development project, and then going into structural adjustment, which, you know, prefaced the neoliberal globalization, corporate globalization that we see today, and the kinds of devastation and inequalities that caused in the third world at large, right, and specifically in Muslim countries as well. And because in Muslim countries there was this this worldview that was already being promoted, you know, by right wing the domestic right wing and the US right wing, people turned to that as an alternative, right, as a sort of way to explain what was happening to them, to the loss of their livelihood. And it's the same that's happening under sort of, you know, it's continuing under the so-called war on terror, which is accompanied by neoliberal policies, right? So it's kind of this dual thing where people across the world see that U.S. imperialism is deeply Islamophobic, no matter what the U.S. chooses to say, right? I mean, in terms of its actions, it appears to be completely Islamophobic, and is. I think there's a deep racism at work there. And on the other hand, the other side of it is the neoliberal corporate globalization that is rapidly devastating livelihoods for people. And people need to search for meaning in all of this. They need to be able to explain this. And because the left wing has been systematically eliminated, the only vision that comes to the fore to explain this to them is right-wing radicalism.
Something just happened that sort of it really interested me and sort of made me sort of realize some of the differences in the sort of notions of religion that perhaps exists in the West and sort of in difference with sort of what exists in Islamic countries. You know, the Pope just went to Brazil, and I remember reading something about how he there was a whole question about how he's going to deal with the whole liberation theology, the tradition of liberation theology that exists in Latin America, and it was a big hoopla about it. And the Pope's stand was, you know, like,
of course,
not
he's
good.
A guy who spent much of his last few years fighting attacking.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. But his thing was like, you know, we need to sort of, there needs to be a space between religion and politics. And religion theology expands that space, so we're against it. That was his resistance with religion theology. It politicizes our religion. And it's thoroughly hypocritical of him to say that.
It's pretty ludicrous for the Catholic Church.
Absolutely, right? But see, that hypocrisy, I mean, other hypocrisies exist within Islamic society, but that hypocrisy doesn't exist. The idea that somehow Islam and a mullah, a cleric, somebody is also a political being and has a political role to play in society is not even questioned. You know what I mean? That veneer of like, oh, well, we should keep our religion sort of away from the dirty politics is not there. Islam is a very political religion. You know, I don't know if it's always been or is it a result of colonialism, imperialism, resistance to imperialism. It's probably a mixture of all those. But right now what we have in Islamic world is this notion that Islam is a very valid form to resist and to do politics. You know, and I think for Americans who have this sort of illusion that somehow religion is this pure thing that's not political, although of course it is.
Even
you know,
in the US.
I mean, it works against some of the ideals or some of our own hypocrisies in the West. Do you see what I mean? And right. I think that for people is sort of very disconcerting to see religion that's not afraid of saying we are political.
We say in God, it says in God we trust in our money, so right. we're never far from it.
I mean, look at what's happened to Europe in the last few years, right? I mean, that whole veneer of secularism has just been torn to shreds in terms of the deep xenophobia that European countries have vis-a-vis the minorities in their midst, right? You know, which is directly connected to their colonial past, which is something else that they don't want to acknowledge.
It's almost like a rebirth of the original Enlightenment structure where you have to have reason posited against unreason. The unreason mm-hmm. are all those dusky primitive people out there. Now the dusky primitive people are right in their midst, and so this is almost being brought home, the intellectual history of
tolerance. And if you're not willing to acknowledge the fact that unreason exists within yourself as well, you know, that's the problem. If we sort of split it up in terms of we are reason and they are unreason, then, yeah.
Well, there still are, you know, feminists and gay activists operating in places like Iran. Is there anything that Americans can do for them, or is it the best thing we can do for them to try to de-imperialize our own regime?
I think allowing spaces to exist for gay activists in Iran, there are gay activists in Iran. Gay activists in Iran who are actually in touch with Doug Ireland. You know, I mean, Doug Ireland is informed by a certain section of gay activism in Iran. And what's interesting is that the kind of debates and the kind of changes, the kind of really sort of, you know, steps that are being taken to open up spaces for sexual minorities in Iran, which exists, which all these gay activists know about, that doesn't get filtered at all in the West. What we hear is sort of the repression of gays. We don't hear about sort of the fact that gays can get, from the Iranian military, there's a clause that if you are gay, if you say I'm gay, and you go to a psychologist and they presume that you're gay, you don't have to serve in the army. So you know what I mean? There are all these various contradictions.
That should greatly increase the number of gay Iranians.
I mean, people use it. You know what I mean? So if that exists in a society, it's also, you know what I mean? So the contradictions exist in that society, and people are using those contradictions to open up space for themselves. You know what I mean? Everybody knows about this. But when you don't talk about that part of it, the fact that there are spaces that people know about or using to, you know, for you know, to create some breathing room for themselves, if you don't talk about that, all you hear about is gay repression, you're basically projecting, you know, your own understanding of the world onto them, and what that ultimately does, it actually I think is destroying any possibility of an indigenous sort of discussion around sexuality, which exists. You know, the whole question of transsexuals in Iran, which is legalized, transsexuality is legalized, and through that there's discussion about, well, if that's legalized, then how about this one, how about homosexuality? That's been said, that's openly being talked about. You know what I mean? So there are ways that society is talking about these questions. When you sort of attack it as homophobic, you know what I mean? The ways they're talking about it gets completely erased, and it is being erased because this whole Western language of gay rights is overtaking it and destroying any kind of indigenous possibility of thinking about sexual liberation of sexual minorities, of thinking about how do you actually, you know, get rights, legal rights for people to be able to, you know, live a certain lifestyle, all of which is happening in Iran. If you read this kind of like hysterical sort of Western understanding of Iran, you'd feel like nothing like that is happening at all.
Well, it's kind of a perverse imperialism. We know better. You know?
Right.
And we're imposing our own understanding of the world on these other people. Right. And there are people on the side who are buying that, you know what I mean, who are buying into that understanding of the world and saying, Well, they're right. We are a homophobic society. You know what I mean? And that's becoming growing as the way that the layer of gay activists are understanding Iran, and they're actually stopping, you know, actually engaging within their own society. You know, engaging the way they have been within their own society, and that's the big danger in what's happening, in this sort of westernization of gay rights in Iran.
Did you want to add something?
Yeah, I actually just wanted to sort of pick up on that issue because, you know, even though you talk you are asking specifically about how progressives in the U.S. should talk about or show solidarity with Iranian queer rights, you know, activists or women's rights activists, the larger question obviously that you want to ask is this issue of solidarity vis-a-vis, you know, these questions of human rights within the quote-unquote Muslim world, right? So I want to just open that up and say, you know, really the issue is a much larger issue, which is how do you practice solidarity? How does the North practice solidarity with social justice issues and movements and activists in the global South, right? And the issue of, you know, what happens in the Muslim world is part and parcel of that because it's a part of this power relationship, right? And of course, the Muslim world comes into focus these days because of this particular agenda of the war on terror. And I think if progressives are in the U.S. or in the global North are really interested and invested in showing solidarity, the way to do that is to really not be to question why, you know, Iran, why now? Why the only the Muslim world, why now? And if you're really deeply invested in these issues, then you should commit yourselves to them wholeheartedly and not just in terms of the flavor of the month. I mean, what happened to women's rights in Afghanistan? Why is it that nobody seems to want to show solidarity with that suddenly? Rawa still exists. Rawa still sends out, you know, these bulletins talking about how horrible things are for women in Afghanistan, but no one is interested in that, right? So if you really are deeply committed to issues of social justice, you should be committed to issues of social justice here and there and understand that here and there are not two separate places. They're deeply interconnected by and inflected by a relationship of power. Then you have to, you know, you have to educate yourself in terms of history, in terms of make links, you know, really long-term links with social justice movements and not just sort of, you know, read something on someone's blog and sort of decide in this well-meaning way that you're going to jump to the rescue. So paternalism is definitely not something that, you know, any kind of social justice activism in the global South needs, right? So the question for the global North is to progressives in the global North to ask themselves is what does solidarity mean? And I think really they should learn to take their cues from social justice movements in the global South. Right?
Unfortunately, the imperialists get to dominate the subject or the agenda.
No, absolutely.
That's part of the imperialist hegemony. Thank you. That last voice you heard was Sadi Atur, who is a sociologist, teaches the College of Staten Island, and is active at the CLAGS, the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies, CUNY. And with her... Excuse me, was Koresh Sharamani, who is one of the founders of
Queer Iran Alliance.
Queer Iran Alliance, and author of a piece on ZNet, Gays in Iran. If you want to search for that, please do. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening. And let's go out with a little bit of this from the Sparks from almost 30 years ago.